Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell. Trevor's out this week, and so co-hosting with me is my boss, Cato Vice President John Samples. Thanks for filling in, John.
Thanks for having me.
John and I are joined today by Gene Healy, Cato Vice President and author of the new paper, Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. Welcome to Free Thoughts.
Thanks for having me on.
Were there debates about impeachment at the Constitutional Convention?
Sure. It got quite a bit of debate, particularly in July. And all of the debate really about impeachment at the convention focused on presidential impeachment. And there was a minority of the delegates, Gouverneur Morris, Charles Pinckney, maybe one other, who were against the idea of presidential impeachment altogether. And that view practically got shouted down at the convention with an onslaught from Madison, Franklin, and others to the point where Morris actually confesses that his mind has been changed by the assembled delegates and the enthusiasm for the necessity of presidential impeachments, and he admits that at the end of that debate that that impeachments for the president were necessary.
Yeah, wouldn't it be like having a constitution without an amendments clause? I mean, a theory, you got to have a theory of mistakes to go with these institutions. And if you, how would you get rid of a president that was off track if you didn't have the impeachment?
Well, the idea would be regular elections, and that was Morris's case. Madison said that the security that regular elections were not a sufficient security. He says, for example, that the president might lose his capacity for after impeachment. He might turn out to be corrupt. And I think, one indication of how much broader this remedy was considered to be than we typically recognize today was Madison's statement that during this debate that some mode of displacing the chief magistrate was indispensable because of the possibility of the incapacity, negligence, or perfidy of the president.
What did the English laws about impeachment look like? Because presumably that's the tradition that the framers were operating within and what they were looking to, for example.
Well, impeachment has about four centuries of history before we even get to the Constitutional Convention, and it developed as a means of targeting people that were too highly placed to be amenable to ordinary legal process, king's ministers. And that history was known to the framers in some detail. And that's actually where the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors comes from. It was understood not to be limited to the funny thing about the phrase is it has an odd resonance in contemporary language. It sounds like it's one of the reasons people somewhat understandably confuse impeachment with a criminal process because, well, it mentions crimes and mentions misdemeanors, which we think of as lesser crimes punishable by up to a year in jail. It didn't really have that connotation in English practice or, and that was understood by the founding generation. The, in contemporary language, high crimes and misdemeanors sound something like grave felonies, but lesser offenses too. Actually, it's a broad category of offenses committed by men in high places who are, and it's something that where that in a similar way that you could not enumerate all the rights of man in the debate over the Bill of Rights, you could not enumerate all of the possible abuses of power, offenses, misbehaviors that a that a highly placed federal official might commit. So Hamilton says in the Federalist Papers that these are offenses of a political nature, and they can never be tied down by such strict rules as commonly govern criminal cases.
Do we have evidence of the debate about this at the Constitutional Convention? So you said they pulled this term out of it. It was a term that had been in use, but did they debate the specific meaning of what high crimes and misdemeanors were at the convention?
Well, high crimes and misdemeanors comes a bit late in the convention. There's several throughout the convention, various drafts, various proposals. There's language about maladministration, misfeasance, corruption. High crimes and misdemeanors actually gets introduced by George Mason, and it's at a point where one of the committees has narrowed the language for impeachable offenses to treason and bribery. And Mason says, well, treason and bribery, that wouldn't reach a lot of great offenses against the Constitution. He mentions the trial of Warren Hastings that's going on in England that started just before the Constitutional Convention. He said, Hastings is not guilty of treason. Mason suggests maladministration as a standard. Madison objects to maladministration, says it would basically mean that the president served the pleasure of the Senate. And Mason apparently concedes and offers high crimes and misdemeanors, which had become this sort of term of art in British impeachments. Now, there's a debate because of that exchange that I don't know how much into the weeds you want to get, but some people have said, see, maladministration was rejected at the convention, and it means that you can only impeach the president for being a crook or for abuse of power. But there's a lot of indication that high crimes and misdemeanors both in English practice and as understood by the founding generation, incorporated some forms of maladministration, that some forms of gross negligence, inability to do the job, were understood even by Madison to be contained within the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors.
So to draw from this morning's paper, there's an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that says or argues directly that Justice Kavanaugh could not be impeached now that he's on the court for things that happened before he went on the court. Is that, in your understanding, generally true of the impeachment power? It can only concern what goes on in the office itself?
Yeah, I saw that op-ed. It's by Rivkin and Casey, and that particular part of it at least is nonsense. The idea that you cannot be – in fact, our most recent impeachment of a federal judge in 2010 involves this issue, past behavior that took place, much of it prior to elevation to the post at issue. And this federal judge in 2010, Thomas Porteous, is impeached in part for lying to the Senate about his background and sort of corruptly procuring office. And at the convention, there were several delegates. Morris was among them, and Mason, who mentioned various forms of corrupting the presidential electors as an impeachable offense. So the idea that once you and I'm leaving aside the specific circumstances of Kavanaugh, that's a different debate. But the general claim that they make in that op-ed that you cannot be – that you sort of – you enter the office, even if you lied your way into the office, that you enter that office with a clean slate and cannot be impeached for anything that that you did up to confirmation for that office, that's just not true.
When we're looking for evidence of what the scope of the impeachment power is, what high crimes or misdemeanors might mean, is it always looking at the political process? So in the sense that what we do is we look at prior examples of impeachment and prior examples of, you know, whether it was actually – is it called conviction? Is that the term that – so you file the articles
removal. I mean, you would say convicted in the Senate trial. Sure.
Okay. So do we just look at that process, or is this something that courts themselves have weighed in on? Like could the Supreme Court weigh in on the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors if, say, the president were convicted in the Senate but rejected it, saying the Senate behaved unconstitutionally?
Almost certainly not. The most significant time that the court has looked at this was in a case Nixon versus the United States, not involving Richard Nixon, but actually an impeached federal judge, Walter Nixon, kind of unluckily named. And the court, Judge Nixon had been impeached and removed for perjury, and the what he challenged about his impeachment was this process by which the Senate, so as not to hold up Senate business entirely, had a committee of 12 senators who would review the evidence and prepare a report. And then the entire Senate would vote on impeachment. Judge Nixon challenged that as not – as denying him his right to a Senate trial. And in an opinion written by Justice Rehnquist, 1993, the court held that that basically the Senate had the sole power to try impeachments, and that this was a political question, and it had been directly committed to another branch, and the court wasn't going to touch it. I think in almost any conceivable circumstance, that is going to be what happens. You are not going to see, you're not going to see the House impeach, the Senate remove a federal official, and the Supreme Court weighing in and saying that wasn't within the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors.
So was Gerald Ford right when he was talking about William O. Douglas that high crimes and misdemeanors mean whatever a majority of the House of Representatives think it means?
He's sort of right in a trivial sense, in the sense that if the House impeached and the Senate removed Donald Trump for the alleged high crime and misdemeanor of eating well-done steak with ketchup or tying his tie too long, that it even in that circumstance, it's highly unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to challenge that determination. In the sense that there is not going to be external review, then Ford was partially right, but I think mostly wrong in this sense. While there is not going to be an external arbiter like the court to weigh in on the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors, the legal standard turns out to matter in practical terms. One of the reasons that in our first presidential impeachment trial, Andrew Johnson in 1868, one of the reasons that Johnson was able to escape conviction in the Senate was they based the bulk of the charges on violation of the Tenure of Office Act, and you know, which said in essence that he couldn't fire his own Secretary of War. The Senate Republicans had more than enough to convict Johnson on a party line vote, but they missed several Republican votes. He escaped by one vote, and some of the so-called Republican recusants, the Republicans who voted against conviction, explained their vote in part by saying that they didn't think violation of the Tenure of Office Act was an impeachable offense. So I think when you The legal standard and the grounds for impeachment tend to turn out to matter in practical terms, even if there's no likely scenario in which they can be challenged in the courts.
So we've talked around this a little bit, but maybe it would help our listeners if we made it explicit. So, like, what does the process for impeachment look like? How does one play out?
Well, there's not much procedurally in the Constitution. The House has the sole power of impeachment. The Senate has the sole power to try impeachments. The penalties are limited to removal from office and possible disqualification for office. In practical terms, what usually happens now is if Donald Trump were to be impeached, an impeachment resolution is generally goes to the House Judiciary Committee, the bulk of impeachment resolutions die in the House Judiciary Committee. But the House Judiciary Committee, after conducting an inquiry, if it saw fit, would report that out to the full House. And if the House voted the articles of impeachment, they would—
That's just a simple majority vote.
Yes. They would select House managers to try the case before the Senate. They'd notify the Senate of the impeachment. And then the Chief Justice presides in a Senate impeachment trial of the president, and which doesn't matter a whole lot because the majority of the Senate can overrule a ruling by the Chief Justice. I think Rehnquist, when he presided over the Clinton impeachment trial in early 99, at the end of it, he said, "I did nothing in particular and did it pretty well."
So you said the House appoints House officers to try it in front—
Yep.
—of the Senate. So are these congressmen?
Yes.
So they pick like a prosecutor and a defense attorney—
No.
—basically, or how does this—
The president in the past has had his own defense counsel. That's up to him. The House managers are essentially the prosecutors. You know, if you think back to the most recent presidential impeachment, you had folks like Lindsey Graham was in the House at the time, was a House manager, and Bob Barr, the former— went on to be an LP nominee for president, was another House manager in that case.
Well, there's another aspect of this that comes to mind, which is that impeachment in itself, as removal from office, the second part, is, you know, it has a real follow-on to it. You're removed from office. You may be exposed later to actual criminal indictments and so on. And so that's very concrete. But I think we also, you know, you never can tell about things, but you would sort of say looking down the road, it's going to be hard for anyone to have the necessary supermajority to remove a president absent some extreme. And even if you might have extreme acts that in this kind of partisan atmosphere are not going to produce a supermajority, right? So it's hard to see, and correct, you guys can disagree here, but how you're going to get a removal from office, right? Or that's going to be pretty unlikely. So what you really have is impeachment itself, which is the House side and is the indictment. And it's a very political act. What the Clinton— the harms to the president or the benefits seem to be political in nature, right? And with Clinton, what Clinton showed was, while it looked like going in that impeachment was going to do him a lot of political harm, it actually ended up doing a fair amount of a political benefit, I think we have to say, because the popular judgment was that this was overreaching given everything that had happened. So is that really what we're talking about in a practical terms, looking down at least over the next decade or so, that impeachment is not going to remove anyone from office short of something tremendous? But it is, and it's a two-edged sword in terms of politics.
Well, it is true that it takes extraordinary historical circumstances. So however broad the framers understood the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors to be, and I provide evidence in the paper that it was quite broad. They may not have understood how difficult they had made the, you know, the change to the two-thirds requirement for removal in the Senate comes very late in the convention. They're tired, gets no debate. They didn't really predict the rise of political parties.
Was it a simple majority before, or
it had been a majority through most of the convention? It's the committee of 11 that makes it a two-thirds requirement, two-thirds of the senators present to remove, it just doesn't seem to get very much notice. Doesn't really get any debate. They were not, again, they didn't seem to envision the rise of political parties as happening as quickly as it did. And the combination of that high bar to removal and the parties has meant that you only get impeachments in these sort of – you only get a close to presidential removal in extraordinary circumstances like post-Reconstruction dominance of the Republicans in the Senate and, Richard Nixon in 74. So the structural barrier does mean that in practical terms – you may need something like Nixon on the level of Nixon's abuses to get close to removal or to force a president out. That said, I don't think that it's the case that impeachments are pointless unless you manage to remove the official. Impeachments. There was debate during the Clinton years about, maybe we should just censure him. I'm willing to bet that neither of you can name three presidents who've been censured.
Nope.
Yeah.
You win.
history is, the one that people can name usually is Andrew Jackson over the Bank of the United States, which was then expunged. But censure, while it's possible, is sort of a non-issue. Impeachment turns out to be censure with teeth. It can be used to enforce important constitutional norms, and it becomes, for as infrequently as it's actually accomplished, impeachment in the House is something that presidents are scared of. It's the first thing people know about Andrew Johnson. It'll probably be in the first paragraph of Bill Clinton's obituary, and history is a funny way of reevaluating some of these things. A lot of historians are reevaluating the Johnson impeachment, which was for years taken to be an abuse of power by the radical Republicans, and even right now, people are reevaluating the people on the left are reevaluating the Clinton impeachment. I think the consensus view is still that it may have been, in some ways, a waste of time and money and a distraction, but it's an important part of Bill Clinton's legacy. And in the middle of the Me Too movement, I've seen quite a few folks, Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, Matthew Yglesias, a few other people say that Bill Clinton really should have resigned. What he did was disgraceful.
But in saying it's a political or even primarily a political institution now, that's not necessarily to say a bad thing in the sense that the presidency itself is much more of a political institution than it was probably intended to be in 1789. The other thing that struck me about what you said about the founders was they were sort of on their behalf, choosing majority impeachment voting rule or 2/3 or 60% or something. They also had this big concern about it, the presidency being too dependent on the legislature. So I can see where, from their position, they didn't foresee that they thought the legislature, Congress was going to be the most powerful. They didn't see our circumstances, which is where you've really had a change where the presidency and the court are much more powerful than they look like they were supposed to be, and the states and Congress are much weaker. So in a sense, history has undone a judgment that might have been a reasonable one had Congress turned out to be as powerful as it's supposed to be.
Yeah, Madison thought that legislatures everywhere were drawing all power into their impetuous vortex. In modern circumstances, it's clearly the executive branch that is drawing all the power to itself. What's strange is that as the presidency has grown over the years from a comparatively modest chief magistrate into this figure with full spectrum dominance over American and international life, at the same time you've seen a drift away from – you've seen – almost a rejection of the very idea of discussing impeachment with regard to an elected president. We use the term the I word as if there's something blasphemous about it. And it's become as the presidency has grown more and more powerful, we've shrunk more and more from what the framers thought was an essential remedy to abuse of that power or incapacity and negligence in the exercise of that power.
I'd like to go through some of those. You lay out in the paper, you discuss kind of the big categories of grounds for impeachment. So the first one is you talk about is incompetence, I think. Like what level of incompetence are we talking about here that you think would be or that the historical record shows would be grounds for impeachment?
Well, I think the early cases are usually a better indication. The ones that are sort of contemporaneous with the ratification, roughly contemporaneous with the ratification of the Constitution, are a better indicator of the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors than later cases for various reasons, proximity being the main one. And the second impeachment trial and the very first removal of a federal officer was a federal judge named John Pickering who was impeached and removed from office in 1804 essentially for showing up to work drunk and ranting like a maniac from the bench. What was at issue here was not just negligence but a level of gross incompetence. In fact, Pickering was insane. He wasn't just a drunk. He'd kind of lost his marbles. His son was willing to provide testimony to that effect. And there was some controversy in that trial about, can you really impeach and remove someone for not being all there, for not having any kind of mens rea, just for being crazy drunk? And the outcome of that case was you can.
Seem awfully weird to argue the other way. Like I can see arguments that we don't want to remove people for things that look like political reasons, or even that we don't want to remove people for crimes that happened before they became a federal officer or even minor crimes, but to take them out because they're just not capable of doing the job seems like the most obvious grounds.
Yeah, and I think the interpreting high crimes and misdemeanors is not like interpreting what interstate commerce meant in the 18th century. It doesn't give you as clear answers. But yes, the sort of a level of incapacity we were talking about with Judge Pickering, I think, would be a starting point. There's also hypothetical offered by the law professor Charles Black, who wrote one of the great short treatments of impeachment in the 70s, says, if the president decided that he wanted to move to Saudi Arabia because he wanted to have four wives and to conduct the job over the telephone, it wouldn't look like what we typically think of as an impeachable offense, but obviously you would have to impeach that person for a gross neglect of duty. So high crimes and misdemeanors, Madison said this, and it stands to reason that it has to be broad enough to encompass gross negligence to the point of almost abandonment of the office would be one starting point. But it seems also clear that it should not be understood broadly enough to encompass ordinary workaday negligence in mistakes made in a position that has now included the executive branch is now has over 2 million federal civilian employees. It would be, I think, an abuse of the impeachment power to start talking about impeachment every time someone in that vast and sprawling enterprise screws up.
So I've read, and it's great to have someone look into these things closely because you always check your own prejudices and ideas you have in your mind you've been going around with. And one I have is about the impeachment of Samuel Chase. And the idea there that's always – he came up, I think, one vote short of impeaching him. And the idea – Chase was a
– Supreme Court justice.
And a Federalist. And like many Federalists around 1800, he was in complete freak-out mode, except he would go on the bench and start saying things about Jeffersonian Republicans and the Jacobin elements and all. And even – I think he was pretty virulent even by our standards. And so he got impeached, or they were trying to impeach him for it. And then the idea that comes out of this is the people who say, like, the Constitution has all of this, and then you have practice that decides what it actually means, and that this was an important thing because the practice, what happened with Chase, said we're not going to impeach people for partisan political reasons, right, or just political reasons. Is that true, or is that just a story that
– Well, I think so for the Chase impeachment, Justice Rehnquist, before he a few years before he got to preside over the impeachment trial of President Clinton, actually wrote a book on two key impeachments. One of them was the Justice Chase impeachment in 1804, 1805, and the other being the Andrew Johnson impeachment in 1868. But Rehnquist's view of the Chase impeachment was sort of thank God it failed. This would have been terrible, would have reduced the judiciary to in the same way that people were concerned about the presidency becoming a pawn of Congress. This would have threatened the independence of the judiciary. Keith Whittington, from Princeton, I think has a nice treatment of the Chase trial where he talks about how it maybe it's a good thing that they failed to remove Chase in the trial, but it actually it established a new and valuable constitutional norm, which was that federal judges were not supposed to be openly, nakedly partisan. They were not supposed to. The key charge and the one that I think that Chase came closest to removal on was a rant before a Baltimore grand jury, riding circuit, that sort of denounced by implication the Declaration of Independence and the Jeffersonians. The other charges involved, bias, partisanship, and unfairness against Republican defendants. But after Chase's impeachment trial, he calmed down quite a bit. And a new norm was established that you could not be an openly partisan player as a member of the federal judiciary. And it seems to me that's a valuable norm.
That's really a good point, because we've been talking in the last few years a lot about norms, right? And mostly, you know, it's sort of like, well, I don't know where that comes from, and it's not in any book, but I noticed when it's violated, something like that. But what you're really saying, Keith, was saying this is where one of the impeachment's valuable, because it does create norms. And that's why we think that behavior by officials might be odd.
It can also be used to enforce, you know, pre-existing norms. In the Chase case, it sort of established a valuable norm, but it can also be used, you know, to vindicate norms that we already think are established.
So I'll pose a provocative question for you: what the norm coming out of the Clinton impeachment was? It that what he did and related things was didn't rise to the level of impeachable norm, or that it didn't rise to the level of impeachable norm as long as the economy is growing at 4%.
Well, that's certainly a factor. I mean, look, impeachment is always a mixed question of law and politics, and it's certainly when you're facing a Senate trial, it's certainly better to be in the middle of a red-hot economy as Clinton was. And as you pointed out, one of the weird features of the Clinton impeachment was I think his popularity peaked during the impeachment, over something like 73% popularity in the middle of the House impeachment effort. Yeah, you can never divorce politics from the outcome of impeachment efforts.
Well, the other thing about that one is about in terms of norms is it was almost like a distinction was drawn between like perjury that would lead properly to impeachment and perjury that was sort of not really perjury in a sense. It was kind of it was perjury, but it was caused by the circumstances that, and there's a lot of interpretations of what went on in 1998. But it did seem that there wasn't a strict liability for perjury on the president in that as an impeachable offense.
No, and I think, look, the legal analysis part of impeachment, the constitutional analysis part of impeachment can tell you in principle is something like perjury or obstruction of justice or illegal war making. In principle, is that an impeachable offense? What it can't tell you is in any given case, is it a good idea to – it doesn't answer the questions about prudence. So you could have about prudence, about wisdom, about whether it's worth the candle to pursue this effort. Those are all political judgments that you hope will be made in better faith than a lot of political judgments usually are. But you know, the legal analysis can't answer that question. So what happened in the Clinton trial is the Clinton impeachment effort. Very few people on the Democratic side denied that obstruction of justice was an impeachable offense in principle. What seems to have happened is that a lot of people decided in this particular set of circumstances, it didn't rise to the level of something that requires the removal of the president.
What about incapacity? You've mentioned you can be impeached for incapacity, which I guess incapacity to extent is just like an absolute form of incompetence, because you're not capable of fulfilling the duties at all. But if you can be impeached for it, then how is that related to the 25th Amendment?
Well, yeah, incapacity. I mean, we talked about the Pickering case, drunken, insane federal judge, in the context of sort of gross negligence, but it's probably better understood as a case of incapacity. The 25th Amendment comes along. It's ratified in 1967. There was no specific mechanism for removal of an incapacitated president prior to then, but I would argue that that's because the mechanism was impeachment. In most cases, the Pickering case shows that it's available for incapacity. And we've arrived at this weird because we have adopted a view of the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors that says, and you know, it needs to be a Nixon-style criminal abuse of power. And because we have the 25th Amendment, we've sort of got this idea that, well, if the president is a vegetable, then you can remove him through the 25th Amendment. If he turns out to be a horrible crook, then you've got impeachment. But for anything in between, you kind of just have to ride it out until the next election or until he's term limited. You know, one of in the impeachment debate at the convention, that's one of the things Madison mentions is that the president could lose his capacity after his election. And he says that could be fatal to the republic at a time when the presidency was a lot less important and a lot less central than it has become by the 21st century.
So I think in the 25th Amendment, they were thinking, first of all, about Kennedy because there was speculation about him, weirdly in retrospect, speculation about him having survived the shot. But also, didn't Wilson play a role in there? And Wilson's interesting because actually you've got a small R Republican problem because actually the elected person did not run the government, but wasn't it his wife and his chief of staff that was actually running the government?
Yeah, I think they pretty much shut the vice president at the time out. Wilson's stroke comes up in the debates over the 25th Amendment and what the legislators who crafted and ratified that amendment seemed to be envisioning was To back up, the 25th Amendment says provides for two means of removal of a president who is, quote, unable to discharge the powers and responsibilities of his office. One is voluntary. That's usually Section 3. It's usually invoked during colonoscopies where the president sends a letter to Congress and says, while I'm under anesthesia, Dick Cheney is president or is acting president. The second one that's garnered so much discussion in the since Donald Trump was elected is Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, which provides a means for doing it involuntarily. So the vice president and a majority of cabinet officers or such other body as Congress may by law provide – decide that the president has become incapacitated, unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office. They send a notification to Congress, and the vice president steps in as acting president and holds that position until Congress sorts it out.
We've discussed this obviously. Isn't this a short of a Wilsonian-like situation? Isn't this really just not operative? I mean, it's because the president an existing president that is physically able to move around can keep coming back at you. I mean, it just seems like an invitation to disaster at the highest levels.
When people talk about impeachment as a constitutional crisis, it's nonsense. But if you want to talk about the potential for a constitutional crisis, invocation of the 25th Amendment might actually court that kind of difficulty. You would have a situation, and some of the Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy sort of envisioned this in the debate over the 25th Amendment. You might have a situation with two presidents and two cabinets. There's enough uncertainty in the language. While it seems clear that the ratifiers intended that after a declaration of incapacity that the vice president holds the reins until Congress votes, there's some uncertainty about that. So you could have a situation where Pence sends the notification. Imagine Pence was willing to do this. Pence sends the notification. Donald Trump sends notification, no, actually, I'm just fine, and then fires the whole cabinet. And then you've sort of like the Secret Service has to figure out who to frog march out of the building. It's a really – impeachment itself is a pretty unwieldy remedy to executive incapacity or misbehavior. It's definitely a lot more of a kludge and a lot clunkier than say a vote of no confidence in a parliamentary system. But compared to the 25th Amendment, Section 4, impeachment would go a lot – presents a lot fewer problems. And on top of which, this is the sorts of things that the people using the 25th Amendment hashtag are talking about are not what the 25th Amendment was designed for. It was designed for Wilson, for Kennedy surviving the assassination. Some of the discussion involved scenarios like a kidnapped president. So it unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office means really unable, not seems like he might do something stupid when he's discharging the powers and duties of the office. So I think this whole idea is fun to talk about, but a non-starter.
This is a good point, though, that to me interesting that you've made also in another aspect, which is that originalism isn't just for judges, right? I mean, if we have an originalist reading of the 25th Amendment, and there's no reason why we shouldn't have and why Congress shouldn't try to do that, then we reach the conclusion you've just said. But also the term high crimes and misdemeanors at some level, and I think that's part of your policy analysis, is also – I mean, the words are in the Constitution. They have meaning. All the logic of the originalist court theory, right, applies to Congress too. There's no reason they shouldn't try to figure out what this means and how to apply it.
Yeah. There's a tendency to punt everything to the courts, but all branches, all members in each branch have an independent constitutional responsibility, a responsibility to try to understand the words of the Constitution and to act accordingly. And I think that's incumbent on Congress as well. So if you had an impeachment effort, I think this is something that's clearly outside the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors. It's not just Donald Trump, my Donald Trump steak example, but something that's purely political. For example, there's American University professor Alan Lichtman, who was first out of the gate with a book about impeaching Trump. Among the charges that he outlines is the, quote, crime against humanity of not taking global warming seriously enough. Well, that's a political the president should not be impeached on policy grounds, on policy disagreements. There are other tools available to Congress, to assert its will. And so that's the idea that legislators themselves have a responsibility to try to figure out what high crimes and misdemeanors means and to act accordingly, I think, comes up also in situations like that, not signing on to impeachment efforts that are not justified by the text of the Constitution.
We've seen a flurry of calls for Trump's impeachment. Quite a lot of them coming even before he took office. We had people calling for his impeachment. We've had books, as you mentioned. We've had law professors writing up op-eds and articles all over the place. We've had members of Congress introducing articles of impeachment that have never – that haven't gone anywhere. And if the Democrats pick up seats in November, we're likely to see even more of that. Of the things that Trump has been accused of as impeachable offenses or have been offered as impeachable offenses, which ones do you think are maybe the most likely or the most kind of squarely within what you think are impeachable offenses? Is there anything there, or is this all just kind of people upset that their guy didn't win or their gal didn't win, and so kind of flailing for ways out?
Well, I rather scrupulously try to avoid coming down on one side or the other in a lot of these things in the paper. But I'd say in terms of what's been introduced so far and what I think is likely to get most traction, without saying whether I think it rises to the level necessarily, would be obstruction of justice. It was the first the Comey firing was the first formal article of impeachment introduced against Trump in 2017, and I think that's going to be the one that has the most legs. The it's one of the areas where you have the most presidential precedent. Nixon, first article of impeachment. Clinton, the obstruction of justice. Particularly if we keep hearing rumors periodically about whether Trump is going to decide to fire Jeff Sessions or Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and/or try to fire Special Counselor Robert Mueller. I think if he were to do the latter in particular, that would be a case for impeachment that would definitely have legs. The Saturday Night Massacre, when Richard Nixon had Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox ultimately fired, proved to be the catalyst for impeachment. It's really what drove impeachment in 73, 74. So I would say that that general area is what I'd look to. The issue of various people have made proposals, although I think only one article has been formally introduced so far, about undermining freedom of the press. And these have ranged from people that say that, you know, there's some that cite, Trump's use of the term enemy of the people and fake news. The charges that are of undermining freedom of the press that are based on, Trump's Twitter feed and these terms, I don't think are very persuasive. It's sort of just a less articulate and clever version of Spiro Agnew's attacks on the media, nattering nabobs of negativism. I don't think calling the media fake news is an impeachable offense. When you do start talking about, and you've seen this in some of his tweets, about broadcast licenses, about Jeff Bezos, Amazon, Washington Post, shipping rates, then you start to get into certainly, the president, it is when you talk about important norms, the president should not be talking about using the power of the state to punish somebody that owns a paper that makes him unhappy. You might want to see if it turns out that those comments, troubling enough in their own right, have a little more to them, that they've led to an effort to take action. There's something more than the equivalent of shouting at the TV. Then I think those would be solid grounds for impeachment. You want to see, like, Richard Nixon didn't Article II abuse of power. Among the charges were abuse of the IRS. Trying to turn the IRS against his political enemies. He didn't actually have as much success with that as his predecessors did, or as he would have liked to, but he made serious efforts to obtain the tax returns and to order audits of his political enemies, and that's an impeachable offense. And I think you can certainly make the case that an effort to, say, raise shipping rates for Amazon on grounds that seem driven by the president's irritation with the Washington Post would be an impeachable offense.
Just struck me that maybe one way to think about this that is wholly extra constitutional, it's not about the language, is that you could think of it this way. We've got a way to remove the president, particularly one in the first term, which is elections, right? So the real question in the first term about a president is, is this person done something that we really don't want to wait for the actual election to pass judgment on him? And because it's so dangerous, or it's a sign that what he's done suggests if we wait a couple of years in any president, this would be really risky. Or the second version of it would be if we let it, you know, we can't wait for the election because if we let this go, then future presidents, it'll become a new norm. It'll become acceptable. And that's really what you're trying to get at here, those two things, is the current risk and the long-term norms. And then you can push the language back into that, right?
Yeah. There's definitely a prophylactic, forward-looking element to impeachment. It is not there as much to punish bad actors as it is to remove threats. And, one threat can be a current threat. The idea that – and this is probably one reason why among many, that the Clinton effort failed. It's a one-off. Now he knows not to fool around with the interns. He's been burnt. He wasn't thought to represent a continuing danger in the way that, say, an abusive criminal president trying to turn the powers of the state against his political enemies would represent. But then there is also, as you point out, the idea of, well, if we never take this this constitutional tool, out of its plastic wrapping, if we never use it, because we've come to think of it as a doomsday device instead of a safety valve, then you are stuck with the erosion of norms. There is no way to stop that slide without imposing some price for it.
Thanks for listening. Free Thoughts is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoyed today's show, please rate and review us on iTunes. And if you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.